106.6. That was David Bowie with 5 Years. I'm Dom Robinson, and you're listening to the DVD Fever Show with me, Dom Robinson, live on North Manchester 106.6. It's a weekly show where I look through the week's releases in movies and video games, plus the charts, a look at what's new on TV, and news for all three. DVDfever.co.uk is a non-profit website, and has fairly recently had a revamp, so do take a look. If you've got anything to say about anything you hear on the show, please get in touch via the Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com/DVDfevershow. Okay, the first hour is everything to do with films and DVDs. I'll start off with a music review this time. We'll have Howard Jones performs Dream Into Action and Humans Live at the Indigo O2 in London on DVD. And I've also done an interview recently with Howard Jones. Anyone who's fans of the 80s music, they'll know him, and he's obviously still been around since. And, to go to dvdfever.co.uk, and you'll be able to see you'll see his face at the top of the screen, basically. And then you'll be able to click on it and read the interview. We'll also have the top 10 movie charts. Then we'll have the new cinema releases out this Friday, including War Horse and The Darkest Hour, and some new DVD releases, including Columbiana and Troll Hunter. And it's a fairly packed hour, so if we've got time for it, we'll have a bit of film news as well, but we'll see how we go. So we start off with Howard Jones. Now, when it comes to Howard Jones performs Dream Into Action and Humans Live at the Indigo O2, I expected the albums to come one after the other, in order, and with the track listing in the original order. But changing things up a bit, as Howard clearly likes to experiment, given the new videos commissioned for each and every track, the show begins by bursting into Automaton, and sounds as gloriously fresh as it did 25 years ago. Elegy is still as haunting as ever. Bounce Right Back, missed off the LP and cassette versions but retained for CD, is a nice addition, as it's a track I haven't heard as many times as the others, and it's so good to hear the original as well of No One Is To Blame, as I felt that was so superior to the version released as a single. The Humans Live concert begins proper with the fabulous Conditioning, and then, during Hunt the Self, it was most illuminating to see keyboard player Robbie Bronneman recreate the thumping sound later in the track with something that looked like a couple of unlit fluorescent tubes, banging them into the ground to bring a flavour of something that, on the album, would have been recorded once and just replayed over and over. Equality sees the background visuals featuring mime artist Jed Hoyle, who every Hojo fan will remember, accompanying him here, there and everywhere, performing alongside on New Song, which closes the set. It's interesting that Howard says that the opening lines of Humans Live referred to "and lose my mind in drugs and drink." Well, I always thought it was Lust and Drink, which is what is sung here. I'd love to see these albums performed live, and it's tempting to go and celebrate my 40th. Egads, when did that happen? Am I going to the Birmingham one? Anyone fancy going? Just give a plug for the concerts. They're all at O2 Academies around the country. We've got Wednesday, April the 11th at the O2 Academy Bristol. Thursday, April the 12th, O2 Academy Sheffield. Friday, April the 13th, Liverpool. Saturday, April the 14th, my birthday, Birmingham. Why am I singing? Tuesday, April the 17th in Newcastle. Wednesday, April the 18th in Glasgow. Friday, April the 20th in Bournemouth. And the last one, Saturday, April the 21st. That's down at Shepherd's Bush Empire in London. As for why the concerts aren't in the track listing order, Howard jokes of Humans Live during the VIP soundcheck extra. You get What Is Love, a new song at the start, and then my least favourite songs at the end. As well as altering the track listing, I did wonder why the albums were effectively played in order, in reverse order of release. But I guess Howard just wanted to end on his original high, the final track of the concert being the iconic New Song. Presented in the original 16:9 widescreen ratio, the quality of the print is crisp and clear, with no problems on the disc, except for, at times, there being a slight but distinct lack of sync between the sound and the picture. I've no idea why this is, but I don't have it happening on any other discs, and it doesn't happen throughout the concert either. The effect when it does happen is like when you see someone interviewed on a video screen on BBC News, and the camera cuts to the presenter in the studio with the screen in the background, as there's a delay with the video image in the studio. Note that the specially commissioned videos in the background don't suffer any problems due to this, as they don't beat along to the tune, so to speak. Audio-wise, the concert is presented in DTS 5.1, Dolby Digital 5.1 and stereo. I went for the first option, and it sounds 100% glorious. There's some splits around audience noises going on, and the music sounds as amazing as it did back in the day. Also, Assault and Battery plus Subwoofer equals Next Door Will Soon Be Banging on the Walls. The extras are as follows. On disc one, which is the Dream Into Action disc, we've got a VIP soundcheck, which is about 27 minutes long, which has bursts of favourite tracks that are heard, while Howard explains the mechanics in strict detail. I didn't understand all the specifics, but I did love the end results. Hearing Equality blasting out in DTS 5.1 still brings the hairs up on the back of my neck to this day, while Hide and Seek retains the power to bring tears to the eyes. Then there's a Robbie Bronneman interview, which is 14 minutes long. Robbie is the other man on keyboards who, linked up by MIDI, takes over from Howard when he goes on walkabout to sing around the stage. He takes us through the plethora of laptops and devices on his rig to get him through each gig, including a duplicate of each device just in case there's a breakdown along the way. Then there's a Jonathan Atkinson interview, lasting 8.5 minutes. Jonathan plays the drums and he also goes into detail about his work, which was a little beyond me, I have to say. It's amusing when he's asked to say when he's asked what would happen if there's a power cut, and he replies, "It's time for the saxophone solo." And then adds that computers can be rebooted in about 2 minutes, so Howard would just joke with the audience in the meantime. Then there's on the second disc, which is the Humans Live one, we've got Rupert Hine and Stephen W. Taylor in the studio, which is about 11 minutes long. The pair talk about working together to produce these two albums. It's quite interesting, but Rupert Hine keeps talking way too softly sometimes, and there's no subtitles, I had to keep rewinding it to try and hear everything he says. And then there's an interview with Stephen W. Taylor, which goes on just over half an hour. Taylor starts by telling us how he was asked by Howard to create a surround remix of a track from the Revolution of the Heart album, at which point he suggested Howard add some visuals to it too. As a result, later came Howard's suggestion that Taylor make some visuals for the songs in these particular concerts, and then he goes into great detail about putting this together. There's a making of film, which is mostly dialogue free, but it shows the digging out of the original master tapes along with the 5.25-inch discs that accompanied them. I do hope they've got something to play them on. Okay, so it's a cracking DVD to have. For the concerts itself, obviously a great 10 out of 10. Picture an 8 because of obviously the the synchronisation problems. Sound 10 out of 10, that's a definite. Extras 7. Overall 8 out of 10. So I think the only places you can really buy that from are either Howard Jones's website, howardjonesmusic.com, I think it is, or if you search for it on Amazon, you'll see he's selling them on there as well. There's also a very nice double CD set of the two albums in like a remastered form. Lovely box set. I've got one of them. Okay, so I have a bit more music, and what we'll do is we'll have Howard Jones singing Automaton, which is one of his favourite songs from Dream Into Action. And of course I've already mentioned the interview, but I'll mention it again. Just go to dvdfever.co.uk and you'll see it on there. You'll see a link to it on there. Okay, so here we go. Howard Jones and Automaton. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Okay, that was Howard Jones with Automaton. And you're back on the DVD Fever show with me, Dom Robinson, live on Manchester's 106.6. Now in this section we'll be having a look at the top 10 movie charts, and I go through the US movie charts here as I could never find a reliable source for the UK ones. The Internet Movie Database was particularly hit and miss, and the Rotten Tomatoes site just wasn't ideal. So anyway, at number one we've got, unsurprisingly, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which took $29.4 million in the last week, and overall it's taken $141 million so far. A terrorist bombing destroys the Kremlin while IMF agent Ethan Hunt is carrying out an undercover operation in Moscow. The Russian government categorises the attack as an undeclared act of war, prompting the United States government to initiate a black operation known as Ghost Protocol, disavowing the entire Impossible Mission Force. Hunt and his four-person team are allowed to escape from the government's custody as part of a plan to enable them to operate outside their agency's command structure. However, when the IMF is ambushed, they are forced to operate without any kind of official support in an attempt to locate an intelligence source connected to the Moscow bombing and the attack on the IMF. Starring Tom Cruise, as always, plus Jeremy Renner, Simon Pegg, Michael Nyquist and Ring Rhames in an uncredited performance, the trailer makes it look amazing, but on the other hand, Cruise has long hair again. And out of the previous films in the series, only the second one featured him with long hair, and that was the only rubbish one, with number one and three being absolutely brilliant. Number two, we've got Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows. That took $20.9 million in the last week, so it's taken $137 million overall, so you know, not far behind Mission Impossible. Now, Sherlock Holmes, Robert Downey Jr., has always been the smartest man in the room, until now. There was a new criminal mastermind at large, Professor James Moriarty, Jared Harris, and not only is he Holmes' intellectual equal, but his capacity for evil, coupled with a complete lack of conscience, may actually give him an advantage over the renowned detective. When the Crown Prince of Austria is found dead, the evidence, as construed by Inspector Lestrade, Eddie Marsden, points to suicide. But Sherlock Holmes deduces that the Prince has been the victim of murder, a murder that is only one piece of a larger and much more portentous puzzle, designed by one Professor Moriarty. Mixing business with pleasure, Holmes tracks the clues to an underground gentleman's club, where he and his brother Mycroft Holmes, Stephen Fry, are toasting Dr. Watson, Jude Law, on his last night of bachelorhood. It is there that Holmes encounters Sim, Noomi Rapace, a gypsy fortune teller, who sees sees more than she is telling, and whose unwitting involvement in the prince's murder makes her the killer's next target. Holmes barely manages to save her life, and in return she reluctantly agrees to help him. The investigation becomes ever more dangerous as it leads Holmes, Watson and Sim across the continent, from England to France to Germany and finally to Switzerland. But the cunning Moriarty is always one step ahead as he spins a web of death and destruction, all part of a greater plan that, if he succeeds, will change the course of history. Now, I don't know if I'll go and see this, because the first one was a massive disappointment, apart from the fantastic oldie-worldy London backdrops. I might give Guy Ritchie a second chance, but I'll most likely wait until it comes out on Blu-ray, and then I'll only look out for it if there's not much else around at the time. Number three, we've got Alvin and the Chipmunks, Chipwrecked, which is overall taken just under $100 million so far. What's wrong with people? The Chipmunks and the Chipettes, three female counterparts to the Chipmunks, go on a cruise trip with the Chipmunks' owner-stroke-manager-stroke-father figure, Dave Seville, Jason Lee. During the cruise, the Monks and the Etts turn the ship into their personal playground, causing trouble and running amok as they will. Eventually, their chaotic behaviour gets them shipwrecked on the Isles of Scilly, getting everyone lost in the process. And as Dave sets out to look for the lost Chipmunk trios, the six find a new castaway on the island, who turns out to be more than a match for the trios. My thoughts on the trailer? Oh dear. Avoid, avoid, avoid. By the way, I haven't mentioned, just go to the Facebook page, facebook.com/DVDFeverShow, if you want to see all the trailers for these films as well. And if you want to avoid hearing me cough. Number four, we've got The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which has taken to date $60 million. This is the second film to be adapted from the Swedish novel of the same name by Stieg Larsson. The first film was the original Swedish language adaptation from 2009. This is the American remake, written by Steven Zalian and directed by David Fincher. Daniel Craig stars as Mikael Blomqvist. Strange why they didn't change the names, but I don't know. He probably won't sound whatever language it's in. Swedish, that's it. And Rooney Mara stars as Lisbeth Salander. In essence, the film follows a man's mission to find out what's happened to a girl who's been missing for 36 years and may have been murdered. The fast-paced trailer doesn't give much away, as there's no dialogue in it, and I've not yet seen any of the original trilogy. I'd be in more of a mind to go and watch those instead. If you've seen them, let me know what you think on the Facebook page. Number five, we've got War Horse, which has taken $14.1 million in the last week, and there'll be more about this in the new releases section. And number six, we've got a film called We Bought a Zoo, which has taken $13.2 million in this past week. Now, Benjamin Mee, Matt Damon, is recently widowed, and his 14-year-old son Dylan is expelled from school. Benjamin decides to begin again in new surroundings, wanting to get away from the sad reminders of his deceased wife. He finally buys a large house with a zoo in the backyard. At first reluctant to take on the zoo with its animals, he decides to give it a try. Although his young daughter, 7-year-old Rosie, is happy with the animals, Dylan is unhappy and retreats into his artwork. Benjamin meets the staff of the zoo, headed by the attractive Kelly Foster, Scarlett Johansson. They must meet the stringent requirements in order to open in the summer and proceed to work to upgrade the zoo's facilities. The zoo runs into trouble when Benjamin's bank account starts to run out of money. The morale of the workers starts to dip as they think that Benjamin will sell the property away like the previous owner. Benjamin miraculously discovered that his late wife had an investment account, with instructions for him to use the money wisely while listening to his heart and ignoring his older brother. This discovery lifts the spirits of the zoo workers. When Dylan is having relationship problems with a girl called Lily, Benjamin gives his son advice on reconciling with her, saying that he just needs 20 seconds of insane courage. And they end up using Dylan's artwork as the logo for the zoo. Now, the film was released in the UK on March the 16th, and, well, as I say, it stars Matt Damon and Scarlett Johansson, but it also comes from Cameron Crowe, the director of Jerry Maguire. Now, I love that film, but based on the trailer for this, it starts off okay with a bit of humour, but soon falls apart into schmaltzy rubbish. I suppose that did a bit in places, but it just seems to get too much, unless I've just dressed it up for the trailer, but nothing that I particularly want to rush out to see. Number 7, we've got The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn, which has taken $11.4 million in the past week. Having bought a model ship, the Unicorn, for a pound off the market stall, Tintin is initially puzzled that the sinister Mr. Sarkarine should be so eager to buy it from him, resorting to murder and kidnapping Tintin, accompanied by his marvellous dog Snowy, to join him and his gang as they sail to Morocco on an old cargo ship. Sarkarine has bribed the crew to revolt against the ship's master, drunken Captain Haddock, but Tintin, Snowy and Haddock escape, arriving in Morocco at the court of a sheikh who also has a model of the unicorn. Haddock tells Tintin that over 300 years earlier, his ancestor, Sir Francis Haddock, was forced to scuttle the original unicorn when attacked by a piratical forebear of Sakharin, but he managed to save the treasure and provide clues to his location in 3 separate scrolls, all of which were secreted in models of the unicorn. Tintin and Sakharin have one of each, and the villain intends to use the glass-shattering top C's of operatic soprano, the Milanese Nightingale, to secure the third. With aid from the bumbling Interpol agents, the Thompson twins, a boy hero, his dog, and the captain must prevent Sakharin from obtaining all 3 scrolls to fulfil the prophecy that only the last of the Haddocks can discover the treasure's whereabouts. Now, this came out in the UK in October and completely passed me by. The trailer didn't do a lot for me either, to encourage me into it, but over here it'll be no doubt be out on DVD and Blu-ray soon anyway. Probably won't be rushing into it. Number 8, still hanging in there, we've got New Year's Eve, just a film where there's lots of intertwining stories going on, all from famous names, but based on the trailer, this is no Magnolia. Just avoid it. Number 9, we've got The Darkest Hour. There'll be more about this in the cinema releases. And then number 10, we've got The Descendants. Okay, so that's your top 10 movie charts for this week. And we'll have a bit of music in the moment, and after that we'll have the new cinema releases. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Okay, you're back with the DVD Fever Show, me, Dom Robinson, live at Manchester's 106.6. And this section we'll be having a look at the new cinema releases out this Friday. And we start off with War Horse. And in Devon, England, of course it's Devon's in England, but, well, this was taken from an American website, so what do you expect? A thoroughbred horse is born, admired by young Albert Narracott. Much to the dismay of his mother, Rose, Albert's father, Ted, purchases the colt, I said colt, at an auction where he was originally looking to buy a plough horse for his farm. The purchase is also in spite of his landlord, Lyons, who tries to outbid him for the colt. Can't help saying, okay, I'm laughing now. Albert names the horse Joey and devotes much of his time to training him. Albert teaches Joey to come when he whistles, interesting, with his hands. All the while, best friend Andrew Easton watches. Ted doesn't have enough money for rent and promises Lyons his money after Joey ploughs the field and they sell turnips from the harvest. Ted has a bad leg and is an alcoholic. Rose shows Albert his father's medals from the Second Boer War in South Africa, where Ted served with the Imperial Yeomanry. Ted was severely wounded in action after the war, or in the war rather, and received the Distinguished Conduct Medal for bravery under fire. She gives him his father's regimental pennant, telling Albert that his father wasn't proud about what he did during the war, and that he had thrown away the flag and the medals, which Rose saved and kept hidden. Albert trains Joey to haul the plough, and to the astonishment of incredulous neighbours, prepares a stony hillside for a crop of turnips. A rainstorm wipes out the turnip field, and to pay overdue rental debts, and without telling Albert, Ted sells Joey to Captain Nichols at the start of World War I, Albert learns of the transaction too late, but the captain promises to take care of the horse and hopefully return Joey after the war. Albert tries to volunteer, but is too young to join the army. Albert ties his father's pendant to Joey's bridle before he leaves with the captain. Ah. Now, starring newcomer Jeremy Irvine as Albert Narracott, plus Peter Mullen, Emily Watson, David Thewlis, Benedict Cumberbatch, aka Sherlock, and Toby Kebbell, who was in a very good film last year called The Veteran. And he was also in, if you watch Black Mirror, which we'll be mentioning later on, The Entire History of You, the third episode. He was in that as well as the lead guy. Now, I've seen clips of this film, and I know it'll head the bill at the Oscars, but it's the kind of film that really doesn't interest me, partly because it's one of those films where they tell you that you must see it, and the subject matter does nothing for me either. Then we have The Darkest Hour, which is an American science fiction film directed by Chris Gorick and produced by Timur Bekmambetov. Sounds like a footballer. Now, the American-based production depicts an alien invasion in Russia and stars Emilia Hirsch, Max Minghella, Olivia Thirlby and Rachel Taylor as young people caught in the invasion. So in Moscow, five young people, each with different goals, must work together to survive after an alien race has invaded Earth. Now, the baddies suck up all the energy in the world, causing electricity supplies to drop to zero. There's a stack of cool CGI in here and also clever aspects to it on show, which to me, I mean, quite honestly, it's difficult to describe it. It just makes it look like the first must-see film of 2012. It's decent to see a film that's sort of taking a punt on all these special effects with pretty much an unknown cast. Yeah, definitely. I know I'm not really selling it very well, but it does look fantastic. Watch the trailer. That's on the that'll be on the Facebook page, facebook.com/DVDFeverShow. Then we have Shame, where Brandon is a 30-something man living in New York who is unable to manage his sex life. Oh, what a pity. Jamie's got one. I'm sharing too much. After his wayward younger sister moves into his apartment, Brandon's world spirals out of control. Get my words out. From director Steve McQueen, Hunger, Shame is a compelling and timely examination of the nature of need, how we live our lives, and the experiences that shape us. Starring Michael Fassbender and Carey Mulligan, the trailer doesn't really go into a lot of descriptive detail, so I think it's just one of those films where you'll just have to see it to see what's actually going on. Now, with the lead cast, it's definitely one to watch. I didn't like Hunger, but Fassbender was fantastic in X-Men First Class, and Carey Mulligan is just hot, even if she's in a duff film. An Education, I have to say, that was definitely a duff film. I was really looking forward to that, and just it was just disappointing. Then we have Margin Call. Junior employees Seth Bregman, Penn Badgley, and Peter Sullivan, Zachary Quinto, and senior trader Will Emerson, Paul Bettany, watch as a human resources team conducts mass layoffs on their trading floor. One of the fired employees is Eric Dale, Stanley Tucci, who works in risk management. Before leaving, Dale gives Peter a USB drive with a project he's been working on, telling him to be careful. That night, Peter finishes the project and discovers that trading will soon exceed the historical volatility levels used by the firm to calculate risk. Because of over-leverage, if the firm's assets in mortgage-backed securities decrease by 25%, the firm will own more than its market capitalization. Sullivan alerts Emerson, who calls the head of trading, Sam Rogers, Kevin Spacey. Now, also starring Jeremy Irons, Mary McDonald, Simon Baker from The Mentalist, and Demi Moore. I quite frankly, haven't got a clue what's going on in this film, and it's just the weirdest description ever. It does look like one that's an intriguing one and worth seeing. So, yeah, definitely one to have a watch of. And also, to finish off the new cinema releases this week, we've got A Useful Life. Now, a movie theatre employee adjusts to a new life after the cinema he worked at for over 25 years is forced to shut down. This is a Uruguayan drama film directed by Federico Verrovge and shot in black and white. The film was selected as a Uruguayan entry for Best Foreign Language Film at the 83rd Academy Awards, but it didn't make the final shortlist. Well, I watched the trailer, and all I could think of is that the lead guy in it looked a bit like the radio DJ Ed Stewpot Stewart from the 70s and 80s. But apart from that fact, I had absolutely no idea what was going on. And, yeah, it's, quite frankly, it doesn't grab me. So, I'll give that one a miss. So, recommending this week, skip War Horse, although a lot of you will probably see it. Definitely see The Darkest Hour, and also you get a second, well, a second choice, go for Shame and Margin Call. Okay, so that's all your films. Well, your films are coming out this Friday. In a moment, we'll have a look at the DVDs. They're out this, well, DVDs and Blu-rays, they're out this week. You listen to 106.6.
106.6.
Okay, you're back with the DVD Fever Show with me, Dom Robinson, live on Manchester's 106.6. This will be the last section of the show for this week, well, for this hour anyway. Obviously, we've still got video games and TV to come in the second hour. We're going to have a look at the new DVDs and Blu-rays out this week. And we'll start off with Troll Hunter. Now, whilst investigating a series of suspicious bear killings, a group of students track a mysterious hunter who wants nothing to do with them and attempts to shake them off his trail. Sheer persistence leads the group right to the prey he is trying to hunt, which they soon learn are far more dangerous than mystical creatures than mere bears. Troll Hunter is a thrilling and wildly entertaining ride where secrets are uncovered throughout, thought only to exist in fairy tales. Special features include a trailer, deleted scenes, improvs and bloopers, extended scenes, visual effects, behind the scenes, it's obviously lots of scenes, and photo galleries. Now watch the trailer, and like the Blair Witch Project, there's a lot of fancy camera movement to create tension and brief sightings of the nasty stuff. It didn't really work for me, but I've heard from others that it is worth seeing, so we have a difference of opinion, Jim. Let's see who gets that 80s reference. After that, we've got Arrietty, which is also, well, you got it on Blu-ray and DVD, plus a deluxe collector's edition, which includes both the Blu-ray and DVD, and also some postcards, I think. Now, Arrietty is a latest release from Studio Ghibli, based on the classic children's book, The Borrowers. Tiny 14-year-old Arrietty lives under the floorboards of an old house with a father and mother. Their peaceful life is dramatically changed when the ever-curious Arrietty accidentally allows herself to be seen by Sho, a poorly and lonesome 12-year-old human boy. The fledgling friendship between the two lonely children causes Haru, the housekeeper, to become aware of the borrower's existence. The family of little borrowers are forced to choose between staying in their well-established home or leaving for the uncertainty of the great outdoors. I thought things that live under floorboards are probably rats. And yeah, exterminate them. Anyway, extras include storyboards, trailers and Japanese TV spots, interviews with a few people whose names I certainly can't pronounce, and Arrietty's Song, a promotional video by Cecile Corbel. Now, presumably this film will work for some, but even though the animation is not CGI, I just don't care for the tale of the borrowers, and that's what you've got here, basically. Also out this week, we've got Columbiana. A young woman grows up to be a stone-cold assassin after witnessing her parents' murder as a child in Bogota. She works for her uncle as a hitman by day, but her personal time is spent engaging in vigilante murders that she hopes will lead her to her ultimate target, the mobster responsible for her parents' death. It stars Zoe Saldana, who played Uhuru in Star Trek, Jordi Moller, Lenny James, Amanda Stenberg, and Graham McTavish. From the trailer, it looks very action-packed, but somehow just doesn't really grab me. The words from the writers of Taken didn't help when, you know, when that Liam Neeson film was just over the top and pretty dull, to be honest. Also out, some TV stuff. We've got Endeavour, The Origins of Inspector Morse. Set in 1965, the story follows the hunt for a missing schoolgirl, which draws Endeavour Morse to the place which will ultimately shape and define his destiny, Oxford. Deep in full-blown murder investigation, and led by the Detective Inspector Fred Thursday, Endeavour finds himself sidelined, discredited, and at a dead end. Well, we know he eventually ends up dead anyway, but don't we all? Facing down the demons of his past, Endeavour begins his own quest in pursuit of justice, risking all in the hunt for a truth that will haunt him for the rest of his days. Now, that's obviously just been a one-off so far that's been on ITV, but I think I read it got around 6.5 million viewers when it was on what day? I think it was on Monday last week. And anyway, basically, they're going to call for a whole series, you know, to be shown, which was pretty par for the course, quite frankly. Then we also have Boardwalk Empire Season 1. Now, when alcohol was outlawed, outlaws became kings. From Terrence Winter, Emmy Award-winning writer of The Sopranos, and Academy Award-winning director Martin Scorsese, Boardwalk Empire is set in Atlantic City at the dawn of Prohibition, at the time when sale of alcohol became illegal throughout the United States. The Great War is over, Wall Street is about to boom, and everything is for sale, even the World Series. It is a time for change when women are getting the vote, broadcast radio is introduced, thankfully, and young people rule the world. On the beach in southern New Jersey sits Atlantic City, a spectacular resort known as the World's Playground, a place where rules don't apply. Massive hotels line its famous boardwalk, along with nightclubs, amusement piers, and entertainment to rival Broadway. For a few dollars, a working man can get away and live like a king, legally or illegally. The undisputed ruler of Atlantic City is the town's treasurer, Enoch Nucky Thompson. Make sure you don't pronounce that when you're drunk. He's played by Steve Buscemi. A political fixer and backroom dealer who is equal parts politician and gangster, and equally comfortable in either role. Because of its strategic location in the seaboard, the town is a hub of activity for the rum runners, minutes from Philadelphia, hours from New York City, and less than a day's drive from Chicago. And Nucky Thompson takes full advantage. Excuse me. I watched the first episode of this and I was really looking forward to it, but I quite frankly, I just got bored silly. It was quite a struggle to get through that episode, to be honest. I'm not going to bother with it anymore, but if you did enjoy it, then... And there's a limited, well, as well as being on Blu-ray and DVD, there's a limited edition on Amazon, which comes with a glossy photo book. This extra, which includes several audio commentaries, making a Broadwalk Empire, which lasts 25 minutes, creating the Boardwalk, which is 8 minutes, Atlantic City, the original Sin City, 30 minutes, and a Speakeasy Tour, 25 minutes, as also character dossier and previews and recaps. Then we also have Doctor Who Unit Files. There's a couple of adventures here. We've got the third Doctor faces ravenous prehistoric monsters in deserted London, while the fourth Doctor battles robot duplicates in a strange village. But are the forces of UNIT friends or foes? Find out in these classic adventures. We start with the Android Invasion, starring Tom Baker. And when the TARDIS lands in sleepy English village of Devesham, Sarah thinks the Doctor has finally got her back home, but all is not as it seems. On here we've got DVD extras including a commentary, The Village That Came to Life, where cast, crew and local residents look back at the making of the story in this documentary presented on location by Nicholas Briggs. There's Life After Who, where Selena Hinchcliffe takes her father Philip on a trip down memory lane to recall his distinguished career in British television and film. There's a photo gallery, a Weetabix advert, which is a TV ad for a Doctor Who themed promotion for this breakfast cereal, an Easter egg, which is a quarter inch location sound rushes recording some of the story scenes being performed, a coming soon trailer, Radio Times listings, program subtitles and subtitle production notes. The other story, we've got Invasion of the Dinosaurs, starring John Pertwee. And returning to London, the Doctor and Sarah find the city almost completely devoid of life. The civilian population has been evacuated in the wake of an unimaginable event. Somehow dinosaurs have returned to terrorise the Earth. DVD extras include a commentary, People, Power and Puppetry, where the cast and crew look back on the making of this story, Billy Smart's circus featuring John Pertwee, deleted scenes, now and then returning to the film locations, photo gallery, an Easter egg where you can see, can locate and discover what happens when the Doctor meets the dreaded floor manager, production information, subtitles, coming soon trailer, Radio Times listings and programme subtitles. And there's also, it has a digitally remastered picture with the sound quality in episode 1 in monochrome and episodes 2 to 6 in colour. That's for the John Pertwee story. Some other titles out for this for release. There's a re-release of like a box set of Apocalypse Now Redo, which, why they've re-released it, I don't know. It's a little bit cheaper than the box set that came out, well, in June, I think, last year, which I reviewed on here. But it looks like they've separated it from the Hearts of Darkness of Filmmakers Apocalypse, which is also out, and they're both selling separately. So why spend £14 on each of them when you may as well spend £18 on the whole box set? There's also films called Arena, The Big Picture, Cell 211, Faces in the Crowd, Go to Blazes, In a Better World, The Legend of Bruce Lee, Project Nim, and Stag Night of the Dead. Some TV series and other stuff that's out. We've got Above Suspicion 3, Deadly Intent. We've got The Borrowers, which is one that was on BBC One over Christmas. CSI New York Season 7. Hustle Series 7. And the next series, the last series I think it's going to be, starts this Friday rather than last Friday because Public Enemies got bumped today. They're bumped today late for each episode. Lie to Me Season 3, Little House on the Prairie Season 9, Margaret Cho Assassin, Margaret Thatcher the Iron Lady, a documentary, not film's not out yet on DVD, Shameless Series 8, and some Blu-ray premieres. We got excuse me, Misfits Series 3 plus a Series 1 to 3 box set, Up in 3D, Whisper of the Heart, and there's also the 1978 original of the film, which Quentin Tarantino slightly retitled. Well, the title was pronounced the same, but he changed the spelling. But at this time of day, I can probably only refer to it as Inglourious Bees. You know the one. You know the film I'm talking of. If you search for that on Amazon, you'll see that it's on there. That's the one that came out in 1978. That's out now. Okay, that's everything to do with films for this week. And coming up in the second hour, we've got a mixture of video games and TV, starting with a review of Kinect Adventures on the Xbox 360. But to take us to the top of the hour, we'll have a bit of music from Daniel Lanois and The Maker. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Okay, that was Incubus with Are You In? And you're back live on Manchester's 106.6. And it's a DVD Fever show with me, Dom Robinson. Okay, in this hour, we look at everything to do with video games and TV, starting off with a review of Kinect Adventures on the Xbox 360. Then we have a look at the top 10 games charts, some new video games releases, and some video games news. Then in the second half of the hour, we look at the look back at a lot of TV over Christmas and New Year, including Doctor Who, Public Enemies, The Royal Bodyguard, and much, much more. And also look ahead some more programmes coming up. So, to take off with the video games, it's Kinect Adventures I'm looking at, and this came out last year along with the Kinect itself, but, you know, it's to be honest, there's not a lot that's new out at the moment, so best to have a look at something that may be worth your attention. Kinect Adventures is a compilation of five titles on a disc, which comes with Microsoft's new Kinect device, and aims to trump anything the Nintendo Wii and Sony's PlayStation Move devices can do, both of which will require you to hold at least one form of remote to control it. But this allows your whole body to become the controller. After setting up and calibrating the Kinect to recognise your movements and voice, the effect of which you can see in videos that are put online, just look for the DVD Fever Games YouTube channel, you're then ready to play them. Now, rather than discuss the finer aspects of the device, I'll just talk about it as I go through the game. The games begin with Rally Ball, which involves throwing balls at a wall of boxes, some of which will reveal more balls, and if you can keep them all going at once, and you'll see from the footage online that I can't, then you'll clear the wall quickly, resulting in a higher score. For each game in this package, there are basic, intermediate and advanced levels to get through, and in order to complete them, you'll respectively have bronze, silver and gold medals awarded to you. However, even if you say, you know, manage silver in a bronze event, you can't skip the intermediate one later, which is a pain. Well, if you're sticking to the adventure mode. There is a free play mode which does allow you to play the more difficult ones if you prefer. A timed play mode is also available for Rally Ball, Reflex Ridge and River Rush, where the ability to score points is replaced by the ability to get extra time to continue the game. There's also an option to show off and share, which, as you'll see from the game, allows you to upload pictures taken randomly during the game to be uploaded to Microsoft's site for this, as well as living statues. You can see my second Rally Ball video for more on that. To be honest, I never went to the site afterwards to see how they looked. I see enough of myself in the mirror every morning. And besides, they only stay up there for 14 days, so it's very much a transient extra. Next up is one of my favourite games of the bunch, River Rush, which places you in a rubber dinghy and takes you through a course of avoiding obstacles and collecting tokens along the way. The more you collect, the higher the score. This is one of the easier games to play in the package, as it doesn't require you to jump as much as I thought it would. And simple gestures to the side will move you across the screen. After that, it's a case of practice makes perfect. After that one came one of the most annoying games on show, 20,000 Leaks. Basically, you're in an underground tank, and for lack of any particular reason, every kind of undersea creature wants you dead, and will cause leaks in your enclosure by ramming it. The water effects are lovely, but less so is having to move all around to stop the leaks in front of you, to the left and right, and also beneath your feet. One of the reasons this game got on my nerves after a while is that, as it shows in the footage, it just seemed to lose me, just couldn't find me at all on the screen from time to time. Basically, I don't have a perfect room for this, you know, and if there was a piece of furniture I couldn't, there was a piece of furniture I couldn't shift out of the way completely, hence the problems. Even if I could, the game does get a little tedious before too long, and it's not one I'd want to repeat too often. That aside, for those who do have plenty of space, there are some games which can be controlled by two players simultaneously. Game number 4 is Reflex Ridge, an on-the-rails title that, like River Rush, simply requires you to move about to avoid obstacles, as well as stretching about to collect as many tokens as possible, even though you really cannot pick up every last one. You can jump to go a bit faster, but as with River Rush, it's the colourful and crisp outdoor visuals that give you a great sense of space and make you feel like you're achieving something. The final game is Space Pop, a title which, like 20,000 Leaks, places you in an underwater room of sorts, this time allowing you to float about in full 3D space in order to burst as many bubbles as possible. Again, I had a few problems getting around the room completely, but I really was quite blown away as to how well it keeps up with all your movements, not only in general, but from the third dimension point of view. That's not something I was expecting from the Kinect, and while I cannot comment on the PS3 Move as I've never used it, it really does wipe the floor with the Nintendo Wii. In summary, using your hands to move things about with the Kinect is very Minority Report, something that completely, equally blew me away when I saw it back in the cinema in 2002, and I never really expected to be able to do the same thing in my own home at any point, so the fact I can indeed do that is quite simply cool as, you know. I had heard about a very slight delay between your actions and what appears on the screen. Excuse me. But there's nothing like what I feared, and there's nothing to worry about on that score. It's a very slight delay, but you can soon get into the game and make any compensation necessary. If I had any complaints about the title, it's basically that they are like a lot of mini-games. However, while the Kinect Adventures games are a little bit lacking, they do show that the devices are capable of amazing things. And, so this was the first one I tried, and I just couldn't wait to try any more titles. And overall, I do predict great things for the Microsoft Kinect, and I know there are people who are looking to, well, they're basically hacking it to find other things to do with it. So it will be interesting to see what they come up with. So overall, graphics I give 8 out of 10, sound I give 6 out of 10, playability 7, enjoyment 7. So overall, a good 7 out of 10, and at the time I reviewed this, I think it was about £130. But now you can get it for like £80, and it really is worth buying. Okay, so that's your review. In a moment we'll have a look at the top 10 games charts and some new releases. And first off, a bit of music. We'll have The Stranglers, There's Never a Frown, with Gordon Brown. This is 106.6.
106.6.
Okay, that was The Stranglers with Gordon Brown. And you're back on the DVD Fever Show with me, Dom Robinson, on Manchester's 106.6. In this section, we'll be having a look, first of all, at the top 10 games charts, and then some new video games releases coming out on Friday. First of all, with the charts, number 1, it's a climber for FIFA 12, and I looked back at the charts this time last year, and sort of FIFA 11 just climbed right back up to the top exactly this week last year. Just as someone else said to me that these particular games, they sort of do this, and then they'll just absolutely drop like a stone. Why they keep bringing a new one out every year, I don't know. Isn't it? Surely all they do is just change the players in the game. And most of them remain the same anyway. Just a bunch of overpaid idiots kicking a bag of wind about. Anyway, you can tell I don't watch soccer. Anyway, number 2, got Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3. Number 3, Battlefield 3. Number 4, another 3, it's Just Dance 3 Special Edition. Number 5, it's the 4th in the series for Assassin's Creed Revelations. Number 6, it's another 3, it's Saints Row the 3rd. Number 7, God knows how many there are of these, Need for Speed the Run. Oh God, it just shows how many sequels there are around at the moment. Number 8 is The Elder Scrolls 5, Skyrim. Number 9, Mario Kart 7. Number 10, Forza Motorsport 4. Some re-entries, number 34 for Dead Island. 35 for The Sims 3 Pets. Number 37 for EA Sports Active 2, number 39 for The Sims 3, and number 40 for Dance Central 2. And then we move on to some video games releases coming out this Friday. Now, really, there's not a lot coming out at the moment. Start of the new year, no one's releasing anything, to be honest. And that shows, because we've only got one proper game, and there's something which called a Super Mario Pull and Go Storage Folio for the Nintendo 3DS, DSi, and DS Lite, which is £25 on Amazon. It says that the Nintendo 3DS Pull and Go Storage Folio is the ultimate all-in-one storage and protection solution, capable of carrying everything that you need for your 3DS and the other ones. It's the 3DS Pull and Go Storage Folio is actually two Nintendo 3DS cases in one. The folio features a unique removable protective system pocket which holds your 3DS, two games and a stylus. Since this can be removed and used separately, it can essentially act as a standalone carry case without the whole folio. The rest of the case features slots for a massive 27 game cards, making it an ideal storage solution for all of your 3DS games. It can also hold a stylus, as well as having a mesh pocket for your 3DS charger, something not many cases accommodate for. Overall, the Pull and Go, I've said that enough times now, Pull and Go Storage Folio, it's one of the best 3DS cases available. Well, it would say that, wouldn't it? It's what the manufacturers, it's their own description. So the only game that's out this week is, well, it's worth mentioning, apart from a load of re-releases, is Crush 3D on the 3DS, Nintendo 3DS. Imagine being able to change from a 3D world to a 2D world at the touch of a button. Reinvented for the Nintendo 3DS, Crush 3D is a unique platform game that gives you the ability to change perspective from 2D to 3D as you try to solve brain-teasing puzzles. Crush 3D tells the story of Danny, an inquisitive character who volunteers to test his friend's amazing crush machine. This weird invention gives him the amazing powers to explore his own dreams and fears. However, the machine soon becomes so attached to Danny, it traps him in his own subconscious. Sounds a bit like Life on Mars. Now, Danny needs your skills to help him escape. Packed with the best gameplay from the original Crush game, plus a whole host of exciting new 3D features, Crush 3D takes platform gaming to a level that's as hard to put down as it is to escape from. There's the Crush mechanic, where you navigate across the endless platforms of Danny's mind by crushing away from a 2D to 3D world and back again whenever you need to. Discover how crushing takes you to impossible heights, over insurmountable obstacles, and even disposes of dangerous enemies. There are dozens of levels. There are over 50 levels of mind-stretching puzzles spread across four stunning environments, each recreating a specific aspect of Danny's inner world. You can collect all marbles and memories in each level to obtain exclusive art and costumes. Grab trophies to unlock a special challenge mode that lets you play levels with limited time and crushes available. And never be stuck. You can get to grips with the game via an all-new tutorial and hint system that helps you learn the ropes of Crush 3D and reveals hints whenever you're stuck in a level. And you can also use the groundbreaking Street Pass functionality to exchange gifts with your friends and earn gift points to unlock more exclusive bonuses. Okay, you're rushing down the shops as you take all that in. Anyway, that's the that's basically all there is out this week, and it's not a lot, as I say. I'm hoping there's more coming in February, because there's not a great deal coming out in January, to be honest. But there we are. So in a moment, we'll have a bit of music first, a bit of music first, and then we'll have the new some video games news for this week. Listen to 106.6.
106.6.
Okay, you're back on the DVD Fever Show, me, Don Robinson, and this section we'll be having a look at some video games news. And we start off with the news that the PlayStation Vita's 3G model has not been cancelled, Sony has confirmed. Last week, Amazon changed its listing for the device, saying that it had been discontinued by the manufacturer. However, a Sony spokesman said that this was not true, adding, "We'll look into this now," and asked our team to connect with Amazon. Shouldn't they just like phone them up, connect with Amazon? Anyway, the listing follows a decline in sales for the handheld in Japan, which was outsold by the PSP and 3DS in its second week. PlayStation Vita is also suffering from numerous software issues, reports from Japan have said. Users have reported problems with the machine's touchscreen, while a statement issued on Sony's official Japanese website appears to suggest that the PSP successor is suffering from system crashes and power outages. The statement loosely translates, according to IGN, as, "Recently we've received many inquiries via the PlayStation Vita Information Center, as well as through normal channels. Depending on time, it may continue to be difficult to contact us over the phone. We're sorry to have caused such an inconvenience. As for inquiries regarding the PlayStation Vita, we've tried to make its operation as easy as possible." And basically, the problems that are frequently encountered by customers are that the power cuts out, as freezing in mid-operation, they can't connect to a data service, nor can they register PlayStation Network accounts at the initialization screen. PlayStation Vita will arrive in North America and Europe on February 22nd, as Sony has confirmed a launch lineup of 11 titles, which include Uncharted Golden Abyss, Wipeout 2048, MotorStorm RC, and Unit 13. So also the news that revenue in the UK games market was down 13% in 2011. The total gross revenue generated last year through the sale of all software, hardware and accessories was £2.52 billion, according to the UK industry body UKIE. Software sales amounted to £1.42 billion, a decline of 7% compared to 2010. It's noted that all numbers don't take into account digital revenues from online game sales, downloadable content and microtransactions. Despite the declining figures, they were described as better than anticipated by Chairman Andy Payne. In a year when overall consumer spending was down, 2011 proved to be a better than expected year for the UK's box product games market, he said. Helped by the launch of many top quality titles, particularly in quarter four, total software sales of £1.42 billion was better than many predicted. Out of the 10 best-selling releases of 2011, 8 were released during the fourth quarter, meaning 51% of revenue was created during that period. Modern Warfare 3 was named as the best-selling game of the year, which was crowned the fastest-selling entertainment launch. Accessories for PC and consoles were down 17% in total value, with sales declining by 23%. Motion controller devices such as Kinect and PlayStation Move accounted for 11% of sales and 27% of revenue. The best-selling motion control games across all formats were Just Dance 3 on the Wii, Little Big Planet 2 on PlayStation 3, and Forza Motorsport 4 on Xbox 360. And finally, there's also the news that Amy, whoever she is, arrives on Xbox Live Arcade and PlayStation Network, according to the publisher LexisNumeric. The zombie horror game has players controlling Lana, a woman infected by a mysterious virus. She meets a young girl, Amy, who has a power control to control the infection. Lana must protect Amy and herself as they try and survive and discover the secret behind the mysterious illness and Amy's power. It was created by VectorCell, a studio headed by legendary Flashback designer Paul Cussett. Amy is out today on PlayStation Network in the US and tomorrow on Xbox Live and European PlayStation Network. It will be priced at 800 Microsoft points and £7.99 respectively. Okay, that's your video games news for this week. In a moment we'll have a look at the everything to do with TV, starting with some TV reviews of everything that was on. Well, not everything, but a lot of the stuff that was on over Christmas and New Year. A bit of music now, okay? This is 106.6.
106.6.
Okay, you're back with the DVD Fever Show with me, Dom Robinson. I'm going to have a look at some TV programmes watched not only in the past week, but also, well, in over Christmas and New Year. But we'll start off, yeah, there's quite a lot to get through, so yeah, we'll make a start. And the first one is something that was on just before my last show, but I didn't have a chance to see it beforehand. It was the final part of Black Mirror, which was called The Entire History of You. And in the near future, everyone has access to a memory implant that records everything they do, see, and hear. A sort of Sky Plus for the brain. You need never forget a face again. But is that always a good thing? It stars Toby Kebbell, who I mentioned earlier, Jodie Whittaker, and Tom Cullen. Now, we had one woman, well, by the time the programme started, there was one woman, a friend of theirs, who was gouged and had her grain, i.e. the memory implant, taken out. And she had a new one put back in. Apparently, by the time we started the story, it was suddenly all the rage not to have one now. They did look pretty cool, though, but it can also have a negative effect on relationships, as couples can use past memories to get one over on each other about something they once said. They could also have sex while reliving previous sexual memories, which did seem a little odd. In the end, Liam ended up obsessing about how his wife reacted to supposed jokes that were said by Jonas, an old flame of hers. And it was, you know, I mean, the entire history of you, it had a weird look to it. It was clearly futuristic and everyone had an appropriate house for that, but they all drove vehicles for the 1960s. I mean, overall, it was a really nice idea, but it just the storyline just really had not a lot going for it. Bit of a disappointment, quite frankly, but the idea was good. And yeah, I quite like one of those myself. Especially since I've got the memory of what they called. I don't know. Anyway, The other programme I watched, which was on just before Christmas, was Obsessive Compulsive Hoarder. In a pretty English village with a Surrey stockbroker belt lives the infamous Mr. Wallace, whose hoarding habits have spread across £1 million worth of property that used to belong to his parents. His detached bungalow, four-bedroom semi-detached house, and separate double garage were all stuffed from floor to ceiling with newspapers and other household items. Cutting Edge is given unique access to into his intriguing home where no one else has ever ventured. Mr. Wallace is arguably the UK's most extreme hoarder, and his house has become a death trap. It is so packed that he has to crawl over mountains of papers and magazines simply to move from room to room. It takes 40 minutes to get to his front door from the chair he eats and sleeps in. The garden also acts as a dumping ground for tons of refuse, so old that it is overgrown by foliage and trees. Now, it's pretty scary in terms of when a doctor ventured into that house, expecting to get out alive. I mean, this man clearly needs serious help. We also saw the fire brigade coming round to take a look at how he lived, including seeing him try and light the cooker hob with a ton of newspapers stacked up either side, followed by a man helping him sort out a load of his rubbish, which resulted in Mr. Wallace wanting to part with very little. In the end, well, it all ended very quickly, as the story was only halfway through. Perhaps that's so they can have a revisited in a year's time. But yeah, it's like a typical Cutting Edge programme. It's sort of half a story, basically, and only really half it worth watching. One of the best things we had was Outnumbered, where the Brockmans wanted to go away for Christmas, but they wonder whether they can go with Grandad in hospital, or whether they should go, especially when Jane is their house sitter. Meanwhile, Ben causes trouble with his Christmas present, a metal detector. Now, as I say, this was one of the best things over Christmas, but it was still a bit half-hearted. I think it's basically run out of steam now and needs to be put out to pasture, as everything the kids say is too predictable. But it gets a rating, so it's bound to continue for some time. Then we also had Doctor Who, with the Doctor, the Widow and the Wardrobe, on Christmas Day. And a madcap caretaker greets evacuee Majar Well and her two children, and leads them into a magical wintry world. She's lost her husband during World War II, even though he's in the cast played by Alexander Armstrong. So I was hoping at the time that didn't mean he'd get brought back to life, given that it's Doctor Who. There's also the news that Karen Gillan's not going to be around much in the next series and is tipped to be replaced by a new companion, played by Jessica Brown Findlay from Downton Abbey and the second episode of Black Mirror. Now, starring Matt Smith, Claire Skinner, Maurice Cole, Holly Earl, Alexander Armstrong and Sam Stockman, the first thing we saw was the Doctor heading for Earth, but flying on his own through space away from an exploding spacecraft, and grabbing the foot of an astronaut. When he crashes to the ground, he's wearing the astronaut's suit with the helmet on back to front, claiming, "I got dressed in a hurry." And there's no way Alexander Armstrong would fly during World War II. He's clearly far too old. Then we saw the lad Cyril going through a toy box in the bedroom into a magical forest where time moves differently across the dimensional planes, a bit like that episode with an ageing Karen Gillan. Either way, the Doctor and Cyril's sister Lily have to go and find him. Then Claire Skinner walked through the forest and was approached by three people in suits. Bill Bailey, Arabella Weir and someone else. And yes, Arabella's bum did look big in this. Cyril got captured by some wooden weirdos and they channeled their voices through and talked to the Doctor saying, "Your coming was foretold." And then Bill Bailey et al. Came to save the day with Claire Skinner in a big AT-AT Empire Strikes Back style machine. And unsurprisingly, it was all okay in the end. Her husband wasn't dead, and everything worked out fine. In the end, after Claire Skinner said something about how he must have to get back to his family, he said that he has friends, but they must think he's dead. And in the end, he went back to see Amy and Rory. Overall, this was a very dull episode, as usual for a Christmas one. Very little happened within. Also, making a return, this program will never stay dead, even when the cast are eventually. Absolutely fabulous. And the first episode, Identity, it says, in this award-winning sitcom where it returns for a brand new episode, a frightening visitor forces Patsy to find out who she really is. This Wheel's on Fire. Shame it's not the dreadful script. There was the occasional light chuckle in there, but nothing for which I can remember the reason. There was even a bit where Sophie Grable, aka Sarah Lunt, from The Killing turned up, just because Adina's a fan of the show. Then it came across as a bit of pointless guest starring. Then it turned out that Patsy has a lot of state pension coming in because she's never claimed it. And, I got bored. I didn't even watch the second episode because it was just so bad. Talking about, we had Royal Bodyguard. First episode was called The Limping Assassin, and it was a comedy series about an ex-guardsman who, thanks to a terrible misunderstanding, is put in charge of royal security. Guy Hebbel's first assignment as the Royal Bodyguard is to investigate a planned assassination attempt on a member of the royal family at the Commonwealth Conference in Scotland. Starring David Jason, Jeffrey Whitehead, Tim Bentinck, Tim Downey, Eleanor Matsura, and so on. And what seemed to have promise in the trailer ended up feeling like the kind of sitcom that ends up on children's BBC. They're basically Johnny English without any comedy. So Johnny English reborn then. Quite frankly, the best comment I read about this one was came from Chris Barnes, comedian, on Facebook, who said, "It's on too late. It should have been on at 7 o'clock in the 70s. Then we had Felix and Murdo on Channel 4. That was on between Christmas and New Year, which was part of the Comedy Showcase series, which seemed to just disappear completely. Felix and Murdo had a massive amount of publicity, so I thought at that point you could tell it was going to be terrible, and with a canned laughter in the background, it certainly was. Set in 1908, it tried to put a modern-day stance on the early 20th century living. While I could sometimes see what they were trying to achieve, it just failed on every occasion, such as with a failing pedal-powered typewriter, where one woman was asking if she turned it off and on again. That was me trying to laugh in a really bad style. My voice just ended up going as a result. Anyway, apart from that, there was a boy inside a cash dispenser when Felix, Ben Miller, claimed it was better than him being up a chimney. Yeah, that was about it, basically. Still, there was one good thing that was still to come. Public Enemies, which was on last week, it was supposed to run from Tuesday to Thursday, but it ended up being bumped today from Wednesday to Friday. It was a drama exploring the relationship between a convicted murderer and his probation officer. Eddie Mottram is leaving prison, having served his sentence for murder. But has he learned his lesson? And is he safe to be released back into the community? Probation officer Paula Radner, Anna Friel, is tasked with managing Eddie, played by Daniel Mays, as he settles back into life on the outside. But with her checkered history, is she up to the task? Well, the first episode started with Eddie showing remorse and trying to meet up with his mates in the pub, but they didn't really want to know him, because they were fans of the girl, Georgia, that he killed. Not fans, they were friends, rather. He went to work alongside Ashleen Loftus in the garden centre. She was in the Borrowers, playing Arietti. He started working alongside her in the garden centre with an early evening drink, leading to a good time in the toilet, shall we say, at this time of day. We then saw George's father being put back on antidepressants, saying to the doctor he wanted to kill himself 10 years ago when she was found dead. Eddie then bumps into the man in the shopping centre, and also later on when he goes to visit the girl's shrine. His probation officer is duty-bound to report this, but since Eddie's looked her up and found that she was hassled by an ex-boyfriend in the past, he asks her for another chance, because she clearly gave her ex one. That's not a euphemism. At the end of episode one, Eddie ran off from the halfway house after his room was turned over for suspected drug possession, and he ended up at Paula's house, claiming he never killed Georgia in the first place. Ooh, the plot thickens. In episode two, after denying the murder of Georgia, he potentially put lives in jeopardy and lost his job at the garden centre, and thus made himself unemployable elsewhere. He told Jade he'd been locked up for robbing a petrol station. Where's my voice gone? He told Jade, who's Ashleen Loftus, he'd been locked up for robbing a petrol station. So once Paula told her about his crime, she no longer wanted to know him. Which is a shame, really, because that was pretty much the end of her in the programme. Episode 3, in her own spare time, Paula continued to look into the possibility of Eddie's innocence, rather than concentrating on her failing home life with a boyfriend who reminded her of an earlier time when she got suspended for similarly going outside a job description of what she's meant to do. Here she's breaching the rules by helping him travel to his sister's house, who lives inside his exclusion zone, of where he's not allowed to travel. As time went on, Paula's boyfriend beat Eddie up, and then texted Paula to tell her what had happened, to see if she'd go to him. And she did. Would they get it together? I hope not. However, the press were soon round the house because of a CCTV camera, which caught her putting her arms around Eddie outside the police station at the end of episode 2. As such, it ruined her career and knackered the chances of Eddie being able to appeal. And he ended up back in prison for assaulting Colin, the hostel warden, when he showed Eddie the newspaper headlines. At the end, the twist was that it turned out to be George's father who killed her as she was prostituting herself, and so he wasn't himself when he said that he was trying to get her into the car to try and take her away from it all. So Eddie was on the road to being set free, and on the road to being in a relationship with Paula, which is what I thought made for a stupid ending, because it played into the hands of being predictable. So overall, aside from a poor section right at the very end, there was strong acting from all concerned, especially Daniel Mays and Aisling Loftus. Less so from Anna Friel, whose character just wasn't believable in the slightest. And so I watched the first episode of Without You, which I've mentioned on this programme before, and that was just pretty dreadful. So it's not all good for her at the moment. But that's probably the first decent drama. Well, first decent drama of the year, because it's quite a short year so far. But yeah, let's hope we get some more good stuff. And I'd rather see Daniel Mays in some proper acting rather than trying to do comedy, because he just didn't work in Plus One, for example, for me at all. Okay, so that's caught up with everything from over Christmas and New Year. And in a moment, have a bit more music, and then we'll have a look at some more programmes coming up in the next week. You're listening to 106.6.
106.6.
Okay, you're back on the DVD Fever Show with me, Don Robinson. In this final section, to take us up to the top of the hour, we're going to have a look at some TV programmes coming up in the next week. Now, decent new TV is thin on the ground tonight at 9 o'clock, with BBC One showing DIY SOS, The Big Build, and ITV screening Weight Loss Competition, The Biggest Loser, again with Davina McCall. If you're a fan of Shameless, then that's already back on Channel 4 at 10 o'clock. But I ditched that years ago at the start of Series 4, as it clearly has fallen apart after most of the decent casts had left. The Right Stuff's also back after its winter break on Channel 5, with more guests and topics to discuss. Although it is a shadow of its former days, with its topics being dumbed down considerably over the years. It's certainly not any kind of hard-hitting show these days, but it no longer pretends to be. Some decent stuff we've got Coppers on Mondays at 9 o'clock on Channel 4. And Channel 4's acclaimed documentary series returns with the first programme featuring the plainclothes officers of CID as they've never been seen before. With budgets cut and morale at an all-time low, police forces across the UK are facing their harshest challenge for decades against a backdrop of rising crime and last summer's shocking civil unrest. Coppers returns to lift the lid on what it's really like to police 21st century Britain and its increasingly disorderly population. From the armed response teams on the riot-torn streets of Nottingham to beat bobbies patrolling the quiet country lanes of rural Perthshire, the series hears direct and with incredible candour what officers on the front line really think about the job they do and the people they deal with. Now, I haven't seen this episode yet, because it was just on late last night, so a review is going to come next week, but you can see a repeat of the first episode on Thursday, Channel 4, at 10 past 11. It's also at 10 o'clock on Channel 4 on Thursday. We've got My Daughter the Teenage Nudist. Now, this is rather an odd one, or rather a dodgy-sounding one, but then it is Channel 4. Molly and Alex are part of a growing group of teens and 20-somethings who are embracing the world of public nudity, a contemporary phenomenon that's driven by Facebook as well as niche websites like The Naked Tea Party. They're on a quest to normalise nudity, question the media's obsession with the body beautiful, and encourage other young people to liberate themselves simply by going naked in the streets, cafes, or at art shows. The new nudists are keen to take the nudist lifestyle beyond the old-fashioned naturist clubs. So why is this pastime increasing in popularity? And what do the parents think about their child revealing all in the most public of places? There's also Milton Jones' House of Rooms. That's Channel 4, 10:30 on Friday. And it's a new comedy from Milton Jones. And Milton and his mother live together in a big old house, renting out their spare rooms to a variety of tenants, including Alice, a shy, tongue-tied girl who can't quite communicate with Milton, who's equally awkward in her presence. When new tenant Paul arrives, he seems to hit it off with Alice straight away, forcing Milton to up his game and try and compete for her attention. There's also, How to Be a Good Mother with Sharon Horgan, Channel 4, Wednesday at 10 o'clock. Being a mother nowadays is tough. Everyone's got an opinion, whether it's about stay-at-home mums, or going out to versus going out to work, or bottle versus breast. Does anyone really know what they're doing? Award-winning writer and actress Sharon Horgan is also a mother of two girls. Like most mums, she wonders if she's bringing up her kids in the best way. In this film, Sharon meets six mothers who are convinced they're getting it right, even if their methods are unusual or off the scale strange. Like the mother who doesn't believe in nappies, or the ex-stunt woman who thinks we've all brainwashed our kids into being scaredy cats, and a mum who's in love with placentas. Sharon is a warm and funny guide to one of the most contentious subjects out there, how to be a good mother. And there's also a repeat of the last series of RudeTube, which starts on Channel 4 Friday at 11 o'clock. The reason I'm mentioning this is because the first episode, Mashed and Mixed, features my very own mashup, Snooker Loopy. It got to number 44 in this particular programme. I'll link it from the Facebook page. You also see it on YouTube just by searching for Snooker Loopy RudeTube. I can't say the full title of it on air because it's a bit rude, but just have a look on there. Snooker Loopy RudeTube, you'll see it. There's two of them, but it was the first one that was used in the programme. Okay, well, that's the end of the show. You can check out all the trailer links and all the gaming footage from the Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com/DVDFeverShow. And so that, to take us up to the top of the hour, we're going to go with a song from quite a few years ago by Black called Paradise Lost, which is very prophetic because he sings that nothing good can last forever. And that's true because we've come to the end of this week's show. I'll be back next week with more movies, games and TV. I'm sounding like Alan Titchmarsh now. So I should put a stop to that, which I will now. Here's Black anyway. Listen to 106.6.
106.6.